And we're your hosts. I'm Diane Bortoletto.
And I'm Monique Chicardo.
Let's do it.
Hello, hello, and welcome to And Away We Go F1 Podcast, a podcast about Formula One, travel, food, and lifestyle surrounding the sport. My name's Diane Bortoletto, and I'm your pre-Drive to Survive Formula One fan. And today I'm in Margaret River in the southwest of Western Australia.
And I'm Monique Chicardo, your post-Drive to Survive Formula One fan, and I'm currently sitting in a backyard in Jandakot in Western Australia.
Welcome home, welcome home. We are joined by a friend of mine who I've known for a really long time, Paul Marinelli, who's the owner of Marinelli Motorsport, a leading PR and media services company celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Paul's based in Melbourne and has worked on many F1 events around the world and other major motorsport and automotive events as a PR consultant, commentator, and freelance journalist. So with a big warm welcome, Paul Marinelli, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Di. Hi, Monique. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're so excited to have you here. We've known each other for about, 20 years or so.
At least.
We first met working on the World Rally Championship event Rally Australia that was held in Perth. And back then, Paul was the radio reporter for Rally Australia. But I remember you telling me that you have commentated with the late and great Murray Walker, who was the voice of F1 for 25 years. He passed away in 2021 at age 97. But what was it like working with Murray Walker?
Oh, it's a dream come true. I mean, I started out in radio, as you pointed out, and that's how we met. And from radio, I just wanted to transform what I was doing to my passion being motorsport. And I was trying to wonder, how was I going to do that? And it was from working at events like yours and the Grand Prix and many, many other supercar events, whatever I could do to keep myself on radio talking about motorsport. Then, of course, work hard, make some money, go to events overseas, run out of money, come back, go to Europe, do 3 or 4 events, go to America, do 3 or 4 events, run out of money, come back. That was basically my life through the early to mid-90s and then into the 2000s, or from 1995, I established my business, right? And to go back to your original question, Murray, I'd seen Murray and spoken to Murray at several Grand Prix around the world and media centers and stuff as a journalist, right? And I thought, gee, I'd love one day to work with him. And it was funny that opportunity came here in Australia with the Adelaide 500, because they used to bring him down and get him to commentate it. And of course, the crowds loved it. And I became the series commentator for Supercars in 2008. I was given the job of working with Murray. And it was amazing. It was incredible. I mean, it's one of those pinch yourself moments that as it was happening, you're pinching yourself to see if it was real. And you've got him talking to you and asking you questions about what you think and about Formula One. And it was incredible. Incredible. One of the highlights of my career.
Murray Walker was the voice of Formula One. Mon, if this podcast began during the Murray Walker era of Formula One, it might not be called And Away We Go F1 Podcast. It'd probably go Lights Out and Go, Go, Go. I think that was his line, wasn't it?
Oh, spin, wow. Spin, 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 or whatever. And he was the master of creating, of making it entertaining and informative, but also very, very funny. And the idea that it wasn't being a comedian, it was all the mistakes he'd make. And everyone ended up loving him for it. And I even remember when we were commentating together and he said to me, why was that driver penalized, that supercar driver? And I said, oh, look, it's a situation. He's hit the curb and 4 wheels have left the track. And if 4 wheels leave the track, you get a penalty. And he just looks at me and says, well, how on earth was he supposed to stop that from happening? And it's just the way he delivered it. And he knew exactly what he was doing because he knew he had a reputation for it. So and he was well into his 80s then. He only started his Formula One commentary career when he was 60. It gives me hope at 56 this year. But yeah, he started at 60 years of age. And so that 20 years, the later years of his life. And of course, he became world famous as a result of it. And yeah, we all loved him dearly. And one of the highlights was that and him signing his bio for me and writing in it, lovely to work with you. So there was actual proof that we'd actually worked together.
You're joining a new colleague up in the box. What have you thought of your first moments looking at his performance?
Well, I sat next to Paul at a press dinner the other night, and I found him a most engaging companion to talk to, and he obviously knows a hell of a lot about it, and he can obviously talk for Australia. So with that combination of characteristics, I'm sure he'll be absolutely terrific.
Bless.
Oh, what a treasure.
I was going to ask, obviously being a very, very live thing commentating and with such a quick sport, I mean, it's quite hard to see exactly who's going past at exactly the right time. I mean, if you've been sitting at the track and the only way you know who's going past is by checking the livery on the car and then looking at the screen and going, okay, it must have been Hamilton that went past. How hard is it to get all your ducks in a row as you're commentating and make sure that you don't make all those mistakes?
Well, I mainly did a lot of track commentary and track TV commentary, right? So basically, back in those days, so in the 90s, 2000s, it was very clear every driver had a very distinctive helmet and you didn't have the halos on the cars. Yep. So you could clearly see the helmet. The only thing you had time for was to look at the helmet. You didn't see the number. You could barely see the number on the car. Once you memorized everyone's helmet, you could do it straight away. You knew from a mile away, you could see that car. You knew who it was. Now, Now they change helmets virtually every race. So you can't do the helmets anymore. They've put the numbers back on the car, but they're still hard to see, right, at that speed. And you've just got to get yourself, like you say, the liveries, which they change all the time as well now, but you've got to learn the liveries. And what tends to happen these days is that a PR, a series PR or a team PR will send you a list and it'll have a picture of the car for that round and the driver. So if it's a different livery, you know what you're looking for. But you do need to look at a lot of things now. My last one I commentated was Las Vegas 2023. And that at night and all the different liveries for that event, it managed to get my head around it. I reckon it took a good two or three sessions before I actually knew who was driving which car. It was just bizarre. And you can't wait to check on the screen. That takes too long. And it's so live, you will make mistakes. You've just got to keep going. That's, you know, and you don't refer back to your mistake.
F2 last year. Remember when Hedger stalled on the line? They thought it was the other driver.
They kept calling it. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? He's not even in there. Like, he's not even driving. This tends to happen with commentators. They get caught up in their own little world of entertaining each other and entertaining the theory they wanted, which was this guy to go for the championship, that they completely lost sight of what was really happening in front of them. And it's one of the biggest curses for any commentator. Yeah. Focus on what is happening in front of you. One of the best words of advice I ever got from anyone was Murray Walker and a couple of other producers was, talk about what you're seeing, not stories you want to tell people. Not, no one's interested, you know? And you'll still hear today, they'll tell you about what they had for breakfast. Who cares? We want to know what's going on out there right now, you know? And well, that's been my theory, but...
Agree. It's obviously so different when you're commentating a soccer game or a football game because they've got a big 22 or a big 11 on their back and it's so easy to see. But yeah, now that you've said how much they change their helmets, every single race, they've got a new helmet that someone's designed. They change their livery. They change their suits. They change literally everything. And it's all going so fast. And I know the last Grand Prix that I went to, I was picking up so many errors that the commentators were making. And it wasn't even that they were saying it was the wrong driver. They were getting the surnames of the drivers wrong, pronunciation-wise. Very, very wrong. Not just like a slight mispronunciation. It's a very wrong pronunciation. And I was like, oh, maybe you might need to check that.
Sadly, Monique and Di, I have to say this, and people will probably criticize me for it, but that's fine. It's been a race to the bottom. Particularly in the last 10 years, the amount, the quality level of commentary, if you look back to the Murray Walker days and even before him, and if you look to the States where it's absolutely excellent, like you listen to those guys when they call races, it is just magical, right? And they know what they're talking about and they're precise and they're clear and they study it up and they're good. And you look at what's happened with F1 and other categories as well, it's not terrible. But it's certainly gone backwards. At 120%, it's gone backwards. And they are doing things now, each and every race, that we'd be fired for. They can have that. You'd be fired. Even if you worked in radio stations, you make those sort of mistakes, you're gone. Yeah, we've seen instances where David Croft is arguing with his pit reporter, with Ted, because Ted didn't want to say something that he'd asked him. And they're having this argument. I'm like, do you realize there's millions of people watching? And they don't care about your fancy little argument. They want to know what's going on the track. Like, you know, I can't believe things like that. People get away with that sort of stuff. It's a bit of a race to the bottom.
I know. One thing I will say about pronunciation, though, is that Greg Rust knows how to pronounce Bortoletto. So when Bortoletto was racing at the Australian Grand Prix a couple of years ago, and yeah, I texted him. I knew he was in the commentary box doing the live commentary, and I texted him going, excellent pronunciation, Rusty. And he's like, yeah, I've been thinking of you. So that was really cool.
I do feel sorry for a lot of the drivers when they've got slightly more complicated names, let's say, for perhaps a British person to say. As Italians, we obviously understand Italian pronunciation. As French speaking people, you'd understand French pronunciation. So I do feel sorry for the drivers when their surnames get absolutely butchered by the commentators because they're just not quite sure of how to pronounce it.
Well, the way I see it, it's very simple. You go up to the driver, you ask them how they want their name pronounced, they will tell you. And that's the way you do it. And you learn it, right? Now, do you know how many don't bother doing that? You just go, like Verstappen. It's not Verstappen. Oh. Everyone says, it's not. You ask him, it's Verstappen. You'll hear them. They want to sound clever. Oh, I want to sound like I'm more cultured. Verstappen, which is incorrect. You know, ask him, you idiot. You know, it astounds me. And it's not just that. Well, who are you trying to impress here? You can even ask the driver and find out for yourself. There's no SH sound in that. That's something you've made up. Anyway, but the funniest thing, the driver pronunciation thing is one of the funniest things, and I love American commentary, as I pointed out, but there used to be a driver who drove Indy cars named Hiro Matsushita. Now, he's the son of the national Panasonic company owner, the Matsushita Corporation, right? Now, Matsushita, not such a bad word, but the Americans thought, we don't want to say a swear word, so they changed it to Matsushita.
Oh, my God.
Matsushita, right? And I thought, hang on, it's his name. And pick up on the rude word unless you emphasized it. So they changed him to Hiro Matsushita. It's Hiro Matsushita.
Well, that's ridiculous. Honestly, that's...
I just thought that was funny.
I also remember you telling me, Paul, that you met Ayrton Senna. Tell us that story.
All right. So the thing I want to make clear is, as a journalist at events, you get to meet all the drivers, right? That doesn't mean that you've actually met them or that you're friends, right? So people say, oh, he's my friend. It's not true. You met them as part of your work, which was the case for me and still is the case. The way I met him properly was bizarre. I took a guy from McLaren out to dinner one night in the early Adelaide days. This is back in the early 90s. And we're walking back to the Hilton Hotel. We're both sort of half drunk. And he'd had a great night. And we'll have a nightcap and then be on our way. And there's this two people sort of walking towards us in the dark and a guy holding a girl's hand, and they're walking along, and lo and behold, as we get closer, I realize it's Ayrton. And Peter says, oh, Ayrton, hi. And he says, oh, look, Peter, who's your friend? Oh, this is Paul. And we end up sitting on this park bench having this wonderful chat in the middle of the night in Adelaide. It was before the race week had started. And I just thought, how magical is this? How could you even plan something like that? So that's where I say I'd met him, but I wouldn't go saying, oh, well, we were friends or anything like that. But it was a lovely way to meet him. Yeah, it was very nice.
What did you talk about?
Just normal stuff. Not about racing, just what we did that night, what he thought of Adelaide and what the girlfriend, how she was enjoying it, how things at McLaren. But there wasn't a lot of F1 talk. It was just mainly social talk, and he was pleasant and he was smiling and he was happy. And I thought, wow, incredible. Yeah.
Oh, how nice.
I think it takes a little bit more than catching up on the street in Adelaide to become mates, doesn't it?
When he died, and so many people are, he was a friend, isn't he? Absolute rubbish. You meet them as a result of your work. You're an acquaintance of theirs at the most.
With a particular purpose, and that is to get the story or to convey your story or whatever it is. So it's you can hardly call that a friendship. That's just very much a business interaction. It must be so nice to meet them away from all of that, even if it's only very briefly, but just to see the kind of real driver.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
You've also got an interesting story about how you met Eddie Irvine's parents. Eddie Irvine, who was an Irish-born Formula One driver who drove for Jordan, Ferrari, McLaren, Jaguar between the years of 93 and 2002. So, yeah, how did you meet Eddie's parents?
Well, first of all, I met Eddie at a post-Adelaide Grand Prix party one year, and it was a Benetton party, but everyone was there. And it was the first time I'd ever seen Michael Schumacher get drunk. I'd seen all these drivers, they're all, because of one beer and they're gone, right? And so they're all drunk. But Eddie was the funniest, and I got to talk to him a lot, and we're having a laugh. And there's a certain Channel 7 reporter who I won't name who went completely bare-chested dancing with him, female, at the club. And that went around the motorsport world for years, but I don't think it went much further than that. Yeah. Oh, she was nuts. She was nuts. But anyway, so was he. He was crazy. And anyway, what I loved about him was that he was a good driver, but he was also a fun guy. And I never knew him well. I just saw him at a couple of those things. But I was at the Hungarian Grand Prix. This would be 93. And it was a madhouse leaving the track. There was a queue, not a queue. It was like a gaggle of hundreds, if not thousands of people trying to get a taxi. Okay, it was crazy. And what would happen, the taxi would come. It's not like here, it's all controlled, everyone in line. People would just run for it and get in it, right? I just happened to be standing there watching these taxis come and go, and one stopped right in front of me. So I opened the door and get in. Next thing you know, the back door's open and people get in. And I just told him where to drive. And I turned around and they started talking. And I said, well, look, I'm going to so-and-so. They said, yeah, our hotel's just near there too. Okay, strong Irish accent. And I said, oh, you guys are from Ireland? Oh, yeah. You might know our son, you know, Eddie. I said, Eddie Irvine. He says, yes, that's our son. I'm like, oh, fantastic. And we're having this great old chat and this and that. And we end up having a drink later at the bar. And they were lovely, his parents, absolutely lovely. And I know the mother's since gone. I think his father's still alive. But I ended up, after that, meeting their daughter, Sonia, who runs an incredible corporate hospitality business in Monaco. And she's superb. And she actually worked with Ferrari when Eddie was there, as well as a physiotherapist. And we're still friends to this day. But that was funny because I remember dropping the lines. Oh, I met your parents in the taxi. And she said she spoke to the parents at Hungary and they'd remembered. They're like, oh, yeah, remembered him. That was funny, you know. That was weird. That was, again, one of those chance things. And then you end up, you see them at other Grand Prix and you know what I mean? And you stay friends, you know, and then you become friends with the rest of the family. And yeah, it was quite interesting, actually.
Just to clarify, how many Grand Prix have you been to exactly?
I haven't counted them all.
Because right now I'm sensing it's a few.
I'm guessing Paul's been to well over 80.
Be something like that. But I'd say, yeah, 80 to 100 maybe. Depends on obviously repeat events. There's ones I went to several times over. Like Australia, I've done 26 times in Melbourne, and Adelaide would be about 11. And I started going to Adelaide as a fan with my parents. So as a kid, because my dad was into it. That's what got me into it. You know, he loved it. My mum loved it. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, that's what I want to try and have a career in. It's what I want to do.
So I'm guessing with a surname like Marinelli, your team is Ferrari?
I obviously have a soft spot for Ferrari because they're Italian. But I'm a Mercedes man through and through. I love Mercedes-Benz. My dad had a Mercedes-Benz service and sales business here in Melbourne. We grew up around Mercs my whole life and I just love them. They're beautiful cars. And so I'm probably a Mercedes fan first and foremost and then Ferrari second. But having said that, as in the role of a journalist or commentator, I don't have a favorite. You know, I just try and go in there with May the best person win.
You're a professional.
Yeah. It's very hard. It's like you can't wear, like you go to a Grand Prix, you can't wear a team gear or a hat. You've got to be as impartial as you can, particularly as a commentator. They're not shy in telling you, take that off, you know, or don't come in this garage if you're wearing that. You learn to be as neutral and as you possibly can. Although some of the British commentators, as you can clearly tell, have got the Lando Norris mania that goes on and the George Russell stuff. Again, they're great drivers. The bias is just beyond belief, you know. And if that was for the UK only, fine. But because it's the world feed, you've got to be a little more impartial. You know? But anyway, they've got the gig and I haven't. So.
The bias is absolutely clear. And you hear a lot of chatter about that on social media and the American fans. They say that you need to watch F1 TV if you want neutral commentary, non-biased commentary. But of course, in Australia, we don't have Formula One TV. So we just have to wait until the Foxtel contract ends.
It's geo-fenced out of Australia, which is ridiculous, you know?
We have the Norwegian commentators, but I can't understand any of it. So, but I mean, we watch the British commentating as well because we watch Formula One TV and we watch it on Fox Sports or whatever it is that it's on. But it is sometimes nice to have it on the Norwegian just to kind of have a level playing field for me because I don't understand any of what's going on and they obviously don't have Norwegian drivers. So it's quite nice.
Yeah. See, someone like yourself, is you mentioned your post-Drive to Survive, right? Like so many relatively new F1 fans, right? You need things explained to you. So they need to inform as well as entertain. And what I feel happens today is there's not much informing going on. There's a whole lot of talking about what opinionated and telling you what's happening to a certain extent. There's not a lot of informing going on. And that's where Drive to Survive has helped people a lot. You know, it's transformed the sport completely. It really has.
Oh, it sure has. 100%. Yeah. So speaking of Drive to Survive, what's your opinion on Drive to Survive? There's, you know, some long-term fans I know that don't like all these new fans coming in. You know, they're buying all the tickets. They're making access to Formula One much harder. They're clogging all the feeds with their apparently ill-informed opinions because they've been following the sport for, you know, 4 years instead of 40 years, you know, whatever. What's your thoughts on Drive to Survive?
Okay, so Formula One has got a lot of fans that are, you call belongers, okay? So these are the people like you and I, Di, who from 20, 30 years ago have been into the sport, right, and go all the way through. Now, some of us, like me, I'm embracing the fact that it's grown because I always knew Formula One would one day get like this because it had the potential. Mm-hmm. Bernie was the one holding it back, right? Bernie was the one, Bernie Eccleston, this is, that you went to tracks, there was no one in the paddock. You go to the paddock, you'd be all excited, there was no one there. Because they wouldn't let people in. They wouldn't let celebs in. They wouldn't, you know, he basically made it such a closed shop that he took exclusivity to the point of almost making the sport fall apart. That's how bad it got. So when Liberty came along and opened it all up and got all the stars and got Drive to Survive happening and they came out with all these ideas and typical Americans, they know how to put on a show. They know how to promote. They know how to, and look what they've done. I mean, it's just incredible. So how do I see it? Fantastic. Yes, it's made events more difficult to attend. Yes, it's created fans who know it all in the last 5 minutes. I mean, I'll never forget going to the launch of the Las Vegas Grand Prix, and not the Grand Prix, the launch the year before. I go to Vegas virtually every year for some trade shows for my PR business. I could have walked down the street and mentioned Lewis Hamilton to people 5 years ago. They wouldn't know what I was talking about. They would have no idea. They did not give a stuff about F1. But when Drive to Survive started, that period there to now, it's mind-blowing. They've gone crazy. They mobbed them like rock stars. Even at that launch event, I remember waiting in line to get in, and I'm listening to some people behind me. Oh, I've been following it. Everything they were saying was wrong. Everything. But you know what I thought? Let them be happy. Don't turn around and be that, oh, you're wrong, because back in 1965, you know, I hate that as well, right? But I was just in, and I thought, you know what? They're loving it. Let them be wrong. Let them screw it all up. Who cares? At the end of the day, they're fans, right? They're paying money. They came to this launch event.
They're talking about it.
Yeah, and they're loving it. They're not just talking about it. They're loving it. Like when I went to the GP the following year, I couldn't believe it. The people just loved it, absolutely loved it. They couldn't get enough of it. And I thought, what has F1 been doing all these years? You know, it's they basically let America go. They basically fought too hard, you know?
I know, right? Three Grand Prix in the States, but it's absolutely phenomenal. Like the biggest market for Formula One at the moment, I was doing some research the other week, is women aged 16 to 25. They're the fastest growing market for the fan base of F1.
Yep. That up until now, or up until Drive to Survive, we were essentially locked out of that because it, you know, there was nothing. Well, we weren't locked out of it, but there was nothing that was really grabbing the attention. And now you've got, you know, the drama and the behind the scenes. But,
Well, the fact that you guys are doing this podcast, it's typical of the age group that's getting into the sport, you know, and it's fantastic because I can remember going to a Melbourne Grand Prix. A few years ago, not even 4 years ago. I go to the Melbourne Australian Grand Prix. I'd look at that Melbourne walk. And all I see, you know, where the drivers go through and sign and take photos. And it was all grey-haired blokes with mustaches and beards. It was all 45 years plus. And there were no kids. There were no girls. And I thought to myself, this sport is dying. It's dying because when these fans die, the sport's gone. That's really where it was heading. Now, you go now and it's screaming hordes of fans, kids everywhere, girls everywhere. They've seen Drive to Survive, so these good-looking multi-millionaire blokes. It's got everything that you want in a soapy, but it's all real. It's all 100% real.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what's happening in Formula One is not new, but those stories were only told in a very few select publications and websites and whatnot. Mm. But now the Netflix effect, that coupled with, you know, the COVID and people being locked in their homes and Formula One continuing on being one of the few global sports that continued on during the pandemic, that it was just like the perfect storm. I'm with you, Paul. I agree. I think it's done great things for the sport, for a sport that I always knew was just the world's best sport. Like you said, it's got everything. It's as rich, glamorous, dangerous, and exciting and political as it gets. It doesn't get any more than
you don't have to make anything up. You know, they don't have to even make up plots because F1's so crazy. You know, look at what happened with Ricciardo. Look at what happened with Perez. Look at all the other stuff. Look at Verstappen's season going all funny and him cracking up. And this is all real. You know, they don't even need to say, oh, look, we'll pretend that you're angry with so-and-so. It's all real. You're my cup team owners who are calling each other the foulest words ever. And it's all recorded and it's all real and it's not doing it. But you even see at one stage, Toto Wolff says the thing, are we doing this for the cameras or not? You know, he checks first and then they go off and argue, saying, because he just wanted to know for sure whether this was a put on or not. You know, when Christian Horner called him some crazy, obscene obscenity.
Right? I'd rather be a terrier than a wolf.
And the sport's always been like that. That's why they call it the Piranha Club. I'm so glad the stories are getting out there. And to me, the bigger, the better. I mean, if they could, they'd run 30 or 40 Grand Prix a year, but it's just impossible.
Oh,
wouldn't that be a dream? I've always said that how cool would it be? I don't know how it would work, but I want more races. So could we have two Formula One seasons with like two sets of drivers for each team? Like, let's have more. Let's make it better.
What NASCAR do, NASCAR have two sets of teams. So because they do so many races in a year, they've actually got a workshop full of cars, like 30, 40 cars, and they just keep rotating these cars, and they actually have double crews so they can get through the whole season and so many races. Now, Formula One to do that would be so insanely expensive, and with the cost cap and stuff, I think 24 races is about as far as you're going to get, but it's pretty good too. It's a good number.
You do keep it to just the two drivers and it's quite a nice competition, I guess. You're not expanding it too far that it kind of dilutes the season or anything. So, yeah, as much as I want it to be bigger.
I'm glad that Cadillac's coming on board. I think the F1 should be more open and more available to more teams to come on board. That's one criticism I have, if anything. I think the teams have been very selfish with this whole process with Andretti. And so now hopefully this changes. And because the more the better, particularly from America, very important.
What's the beef with Andretti? Like, besides sharing the prize money between the teams, it seemed that there was some beef between FIA, all the teams, and Andretti. But as soon as they changed it to Cadillac and Andretti is involved still, but just not the Andretti team, like, what's the story behind that? Do you know?
Look, I don't know what personal issues there were. There must have been, but I don't think it was entirely that. It was the money issue that they didn't want to share the money, that they thought that share would be more than what they were putting in. They're paying an anti-dilution fee of $450 million. I mean, it's crazy what they're paying to get into it. All the teams get that. And that they didn't consider that enough. They wanted $600. I mean, come on. You know, F1's only that big now and teams are worth $1 billion now. Even Williams is worth almost $1 billion now, purely because of Drive to Survive and what's happened. It's not because of what they've done. The results have been terrible, right? But now if you own an F1 team, you're laughing. It's incredible. They were worried about the money more than anything else. And I think the Andretti issue, I don't know what's personally been going on, but to me, it's one of the most famous names in world motorsport. It's a double Formula One world champion at the Patriarch in Mario. And whatever you think of Michael or whatever, you know, they should never have behaved the way they did. And then suddenly when it's Cadillac and when the American government gets involved and says, hey, you're not being fair and this and that, suddenly it's all right. You know, I don't know. It's still going to be Michael Andretti running the show. So I don't know what they think they've achieved. They've achieved absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I know. I read that too. And well, I didn't even have to read between the lines. It was blatantly clear what was going to happen, but it was, I just didn't know what the beef was, what the issue was. Money.
That's always the beef, isn't it?
If you've got the determination, if you've got the drivers, if you can put it all together, why not? You know, why should you be restricted from taking part? Yeah, you know, F1 never used to be like that.
How many teams do you think they should cap F1 at? If they were to allow more teams to join Formula One, what do you think the maximum number should be?
The problem is more grid capacity and pit capacity than actual how many can you have. That's the problem. And then you go into like pre-qualifying like they used to do, because you had so many cars wanting to enter a Grand Prix, you had to pre-qualify and a number of them would miss out. So I don't know. I mean, I think 11 now, 12 maybe. Even I'd like to see it go up to 15, but I just don't see it logistically being possible.
Yeah. The Formula Series before Formula One, I think Formula 2 is 22 drivers and Formula 3 is 24 drivers. So that's 11 and 12 teams respectively. And obviously, their cars are smaller, so that it's easier for them to all fit on the track. I say easier, there's still massive spills at the start of every race because that's just what happens. But effectively, if the cars are going to get smaller, you could.
The track is not the problem.
But it's the pit lane as well.
It's the pit lane. Yeah, it's the resources in pit lane. That's the problem. The track, you can fit 30 cars, you know, it'd be crazy, but you could do it. Of course you could. But it's more your pit facilities and that need to be changed. And yeah, but it can be done. It's not impossible.
The size of the garages and the pit walls, it's just such a bigger operation for Formula One than it is any of the lower series.
All the motorhomes, all the transporters, all the stuff you're going to bring, all the staff you have to bring. Hey, you got to think about all that. I mean, this team's got hundreds of people working for them, not 20 or 30, you know, hundreds.
We're gearing up for the first race of the season with Melbourne not too far away, and you're Melbourne born and bred, and your office is on Lygon Street in Carlton, which is correct. Little Italy in Melbourne, for anybody that doesn't know. I've been to Carlton after an Australian Grand Prix, which is where a lot of the Ferrari fans go. Unfortunately, the year that we went, it was absolutely heaving with rain, absolutely bucketing with rain. It really wasn't too fun because I hate getting wet. What would you recommend that Formula One fans do before and after the Australian Grand Prix, like away from the track in Melbourne?
Well, Melbourne's got everything, you know. I would say the cultural capital of this country, and we've got so many fantastic restaurants, so many places you can go. The city's relatively safe. It's a great place to just get to shop, you know, to go around to eat. To eat, it's fantastic. It's like, I maintain that in all of Australia, you don't eat better than what you eat in Melbourne. And it even goes to a suburban restaurant or something. They're all good. Go to some bars. There's lots of great bars. It depends what you're into. There's lots of cultures, lots of museums, stuff like that. But I'd say getting into some of the bars and the restaurants, that's the real Melbourne. Getting out at night and enjoying the city. It's a wonderful, beautiful place.
What sort of areas?
The big problem with the Australian Grand Prix here in Melbourne is that it's not like Adelaide, where you walked out of the track and you were in the middle of town. You're in Albert Park, you're in Middle Park, that area, but then you've got a couple of kilometres to go before you get into the city. So it sort of makes everyone dissipate and go to different areas. So you don't have one big party area. So that's the big difference you'll find. You walk out of the track and go, oh, okay, there's nothing here. And you've got to go to the city, but all your public transport's free. Throughout everything with your ticket. So you can go wherever you need to go. I highly recommend Crown. Crown's just got everything. Don't have to go anywhere else. You go in there and it's just got everything you need. Great restaurants, great atmosphere, fire coming out of the things every hour or so. It's good fun. It's a good place to base yourself. And if you want to see Grand Prix drivers, you're going to most likely see them getting in and out of Crown. And what you will pretty much anywhere else.
I was just about to say that. On the Grand Prix weekend, you can always see crowds of people standing outside the Crown complex because it is generally where the drivers stay. A good crowd of people there just hoping to catch a glimpse of the drivers. So,
yeah.
I got a funny story about going to the Grand Prix one year where I was living in St Kilda, which is not far from the track. I could have walked, but... Pretty tired. I'd been a day at the track. Yeah, I didn't. And the taxi line was mega. Like, it was so long, the taxi line to get a cab. And there were a group of Harley Davidson parked up with a sign that said $20 for a Harley Davidson tour. So I went up to them and I said, could the tour be a one-way tour? Like, could you drop me off in St Kilda? And they went, for sure. So I jumped on the back of this Harley Davidson with this big biker and we drove to where I was living and with my sister at the time. And we're out the front and I said, can you just give it a bit of a rev it up a little bit? You know, because it was so loud. And he revs the bike. My sister comes outside and she's like, I was single at the time. And she was like, oh my God, what have you done? She thought I'd hooked up with a big biker. And I was like, no, I just got a lift, gave him his $20 and off he went. I got home in minutes instead of having to wait 2 hours in a taxi line. So result.
We ended up, no joke, because trying to get out of the Australian Grand Prix, yes, the public transport is amazing, as we've already said, but obviously when everyone's trying to leave at the same time, it's horrendous. Even if you leave like before the podium, it's just absolutely packed. So Espen and I were like running around the streets trying to find electric scooters. We were trying to find different bus routes that we maybe could get on that weren't the direct ones. Absolutely nothing was working. Mm. And we ended up going on this like mass roundabout bus tour. And it took us so long to get home.
There's a lot of stuff going on. There's bands and stuff. I'd say hang around for an hour afterwards because it's amazing the difference that 45 minutes even makes. and getting the masses out. And then you can just walk out, you know, and all you got to do is just hang around, have a bit of a laugh, have a drink. There's stuff that's still open on the track and that. But I strongly recommend doing that because it does make a massive difference. Any event I ever, because you're working and you're in the media center, you don't leave till a couple hours after. And it's just you walk straight out and get a taxi or whatever. It doesn't take that long for the masses to just clear.
The Middle Park Hotel is a good place for a beer after after the Grand Prix. Like, they usually have a big marquee set up in the car park. And it's, I think it's just outside Gate 1. I think it's Gate 1. The Middle Park Hotel. So, yeah, that's a tip. Go there for a drink before trying to tackle public transport. Oh, well, should we move into the final three?
Let's do it.
Paul, we're moving into the final three. These are three questions we like to ask all of our guests that come on And Away We Go F1 podcast. So, Paul, if you could travel for a holiday to any Formula One destination, whether it's race week or not, whether it's current or former on the F1 calendar, which destination would you choose and why?
Monaco, without any doubt. Monaco. I've been there twice, not during the Grand Prix. I've still yet to do that, but I will. But it is, without a doubt, the most beautiful place on the planet. I can see why these multimillionaires love living there. And my dream is to one day go there and watch the race from a yacht or something like that. Spend some money and do it properly. And I would love to, because it's just magic. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And you can walk around wherever you need to go. And it's stunning. It's beautiful. I can truly see why people fall in love with the place. It's incredible. Truly. Never been to the Grand Prix, though. Still on the bucket list.
I have.
Did you like it?
Loved it. I loved it. I went 10 years ago, Paul. Actually, it'll be 11 years this May that I was at the Monaco Grand Prix. And I've said in previous episodes that we had a seat opposite the marina, and we only booked it 2 weeks before the Grand Prix. This was obviously pre-Drive to Survive. There were a handful of tickets left in this grandstand. So we're opposite the marina. We got Sunday-only tickets. We sat on a bench seat, which is a painted wooden bench seat that had 55 and 56 painted on it. No backs, just a wooden plank. And each seat cost $750 Australian. So it was $1,500 for my husband and I to go to the Monaco Grand Prix nearly 11 years ago.
It was just race day, wasn't it?
That was just race day Sunday only, yeah. And I saw a report actually that came out that says that Monaco is the most expensive Grand Prix to go to. It still is. So, yes, but it was just the most magical day. It was so fun and really well organized.
I had to get a quote for one of my clients who wanted to go this year for just Saturday and Sunday. Corporate hospitality, overlooking the track, you know, the works, right? No accommodation, €7,500 each for Saturday and Sunday only. €7,500 each. And that's not with a comm, And that's doing it in style, $15,000 each, without a comm. You still got to find a combination, insane. And that's one of the more reasonable ones.
You won't find it in Monaco.
There's ones on yachts which are like €30,000 to the weekend,
I had to laugh because I think every single guest but one has said Monaco will be the race that they want to go to.
Oh, really? Really? Oh, there you go. It's also the historic aspect too. It's one of the oldest GPs around that track. You could never, ever race on something like that again. So it's great that still exists. And it's just beautiful. It's amazing. Everything about it is wonderful, in my opinion.
It is. Okay, the second question, Paul. If you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I have to think about this one a lot. And I think for the fun aspect, for just purely having a lot of fun and to be able to talk Formula One, it'd be Daniel Ricciardo, without any doubt. I think we'd have a heap of laughs, just laugh and laugh and laugh. And there'd be serious stuff you could talk to him about too, about the sport. Whereas all the other drivers I thought about, past or present, I thought would be a bit too serious maybe. And maybe it's because I don't know them well enough. But I thought with Daniel, you know you're going to laugh your head off and you're going to have a great time. And I've seen some of the private flights he's had with the other drivers and some of the crap they get up to. And it's hilarious. They're like little kids, you know. And I just think, typical Aussie, you know, he's mad. And I love it.
Daniel's also been a really popular answer for that exact reason, that he's very, very fun. He'd be a bunch of laughs.
I reckon Valtteri Bottas would be fun as well. Like, he's really taken on that Australian sense of humour and Australian sensibilities. And, I think Valtteri would be a lot of fun as well.
Yes. Okay, so the final question is, if you were to cook a Formula One themed meal, so that's the cuisine of any destination that Formula One goes to or has currently been to, what would you cook and why?
All right. I went to Imola a couple of times and I loved it very, very much. So I was wrapped when it came back during COVID and it stayed back. Now, the Emilia Romagna region of Italy is just stunning, as you guys know. And their famous dish is the ragu, pasta ragu, fettuccine ragu, beef. So it's a simple one, but it's a famous one from that region. So that's what I would cook. And because I know how to cook that. I was going to say Japan, but I can't cook Japanese food. So, but yeah, it's in honor of Imola, of the San Marino Grand Prix, and of the Emilia Romagna region of Italy is stunning. I love it.
My favorite dish from that region is tortellini in brodo. I love tortellini in brodo.
That's their other one. That's their other famous one. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. You never eat bad in that whole region. Like, I remember staying in a tiny little pensione near the track, and oh my God, the food was just incredible, absolutely incredible. And I loved Imola. It was just so much fun and so beautiful. And I went with a group of photographers who we rented an Alfa and we just went around there. It was just stunning. Very happy to see it back.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Well, with that, Paul, would just like to thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your stories with us. And I know that there's 1,000 more stories in there. So yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure, Diane, Monique. I really love what you guys are doing. So all the very best. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you. You brought back a lot of memories for me too.
Oh, good.
And lastly, thank you to all of you guys, our listeners. So if you liked our podcast, you can leave a rating or a review on your favorite podcast listening app. We would really, really, really appreciate your feedback. You can also email us at andawaywegof1podcast@gmail.com if you've got a little bit more that you want to say. Otherwise, you can also follow us on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube.
Thanks, Mon. And thank you for having us in your ears. Until next week and until lights out.
It's lights out and away we go.
And Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto and Monique Cicato. Let's do it.